This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Tom Rogers. It's 107. Our technical director this afternoon is Jason Croft, and Harriet Williamson is our show's producer. I'm in for Celeste Quinn, and our guest in the 1 o'clock hour today has done a few of these shows in the past, and you know him as the Dean of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois, Ron Yates. Prior to being your academic career, Ron, you've got quite a career behind you as a reporter and an editor with the Chicago Tribune, and give a little brief outline of your background as far as journalism goes.
Sure. Well, I spent about 25 years or so with the Chicago Tribune, most of it as a foreign correspondent in Asia and Latin America, and worked as a metropolitan editor of the paper for a while and the national editor, and was a senior writer, and also covered the world of international business and finance. So kind of a varied career, and even actually worked on the editorial board writing editorials. So I think I've done everything but sweep the floors in the place.
Well, if you have questions about sweeping floors, this isn't the program to bring those questions forward. But your questions are welcome about the field of journalism, about what you feel is right and wrong in the field. Get some feel for what professionals think as they do their jobs in journalism, and about the state of the field and the profession itself, the changes that have gone on over the past years, probably more breakneck changes than ever with the onset of the internet and the blogosphere. I hate to use that word, but it's true. Blogs are a part of journalism now. We invite your questions, your comments. And we'll see what we can do as far as talking to you about the subject of journalism. Our numbers here in Champaign-Urbana are 333-9455. And outside the local calling area, you can call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. And thanks again for joining us, Ron.
Well, it's my pleasure.
We were talking earlier about the challenges that journalists face today with the changes over the past few years, and blogging is one of those. And we can start talking a little about the role of blogs today. That it seems like a very simple concept, that somebody gets online, they have a chance to speak their piece, and a lot of people have taken that to delve into political topics and to do some reporting on their own. But it's something that mainstream old line journalists are looking at, and looking at, I guess, with some form of concern and fascination at the same time.
Right. Well, I guess when you think about bloggers and the blogosphere, you have to ask the question, are they actually doing reporting, or are they just regurgitating stuff they're picking up off the internet and are giving their own opinions? And I think that is the huge difference between bloggers and people who do this job professionally, because at least in the professional news organizations of the country, the news is vetted through a series of ways. I mean, you have a reporter who understands how to go out and get information and organize it. Then you have editors or producers who examine that to make sure that it's accurate, as accurate as possible, of course. And then you put that out, and you've pretty well vetted it. Now, with the blogosphere, it's really a caveat emptor world. You better be aware of what people are putting out there and whether or not it's gospel or not, because in many cases it's not. And in many cases, a lot of stuff on the internet, as we know, is not accurate, and it's not been fully vetted by anybody except the person who put it on the internet.
One thing that Richard Posner had written recently in the New York Times gave sort of a counter to that, saying that in a way that bloggers' comments are vetted in a way that may be even quicker than the retraction or correction process that the traditional media has, of people respond to them and try to correct them.
Well, what you have is a situation is you put out a story, you put something on in your blog, and you say A equals D, and then you have people coming back and saying no, A equals E, or A equals F, or A equals G, and then you get into this argument back and forth. So it's like blogging is like sitting in a bar and arguing over politics or religion or whatever we argue over in bars. It's a different, but I understand what he's saying. Ultimately, I think because you're throwing it out there into this blogosphere, and you have people out there who may be informed, answering and responding if they have time. I don't have time myself. I mean, I marvel at people sitting in front of a computer and able to do this blogging all day long, because I can't figure out how they do it. But the fact is, you have people responding, going back and forth, back and forth. So it works the same way in some ways as you know, a caller calls into the radio station or TV station and says, that story you put on the air last night was all wrong, or the person who writes a letter to the editor. Yeah, that's a much slower process. So the blogosphere can actually possibly react in a way that would allow us to have a handle on what's accurate and what's not.
Just not in a way that we're used to as far as the traditional correction process.
Exactly. And I think that's the biggest change. I think and this is being driven by technology, obviously, and of course access. And what you're really seeing here in bloggers, and I'm not demeaning people who do this, because I think it's an important part of the dissemination of information. And the question is, once again, you've got to be careful about what's true and what's not. But these people are, in my mind, the pamphleteers of the 21st century, as they were. There were pamphleteers in the 18th century who were putting out pamphlets about, breaking away from England and during the colonial period of U.S. history. Pamphleteers have been always there, and they always put out their own little sort of printed blogs, and they stated their case going all the way back to Thomas Paine. And this is what we're seeing now is kind of a reinvention of that, but using an advanced form of technology to do that pamphleteering.
And, of course, back then there wasn't that the established system of putting together stories and writing and reporting and putting them all in a central location every day that we do now have today.
Right, exactly. The organization wasn't there.
Sounds a little, as far as the self-correction process goes online, mm-hmm. It sounds a little like the same concept that Wikipedia uses.
Mm-hmm.
If you're familiar with Wikipedia, the encyclopedic source that is corrected and changed and altered, mm-hmm. and sometimes vandalized at times by its users. But, its proponents say that because of that constant exchange, you wind up with accuracy, mm-hmm. in one way or another.
I guess over time you would. It's sort of like the old story of putting a monkey in front of a computer, and eventually he'll write the great American novel. How long will that take? 20,000 years or 100,000 years? Who knows? But the point is, you're right. There are this whole system of blogging. It's here. It's not going to go away. And I think what organizations, traditional news organizations, are trying to do is to figure out a way to leverage this in a way that will enable them to expand their own system of putting out news. In other words, you may want to have reporters. I mean, when I was at the Tribune, still working at the Tribune, we used to have to do chats,
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was – I mean, we would do that on occasion, but that's really not really a very good way to interact with people.
This was back when the internet was still just growing, and chat was probably the most immediate.
Right. But blogging now – and I think this reporter for the New York Times and some other places, they've set up their own blogs. And they do it in conjunction with what they're doing, say, at their newspapers. I think the problem is this. Who owns the stories that you're producing for, say, the Chicago Tribune or the New York Times? And who owns that thing that you're putting out on your blog then? And what if it's not correct? And what if you get sued and in turn the newspaper or the organization gets sued because of something that's wrong? And I think blogging right now is the biggest boon to the law profession of anything that I can recent memory, because eventually what's going to happen is people are going to start filing libel suits against these bloggers for stuff that they're putting out, and it's going to be tracked back, and people are going to be sued for this. And I think it's going to be a huge moneymaker for attorneys.
Well, especially people who are blogging under their employer's website, for
exactly.
example, all those reporters' blogs, they have to vet their stories. Is there a second sub-level of vetting that's being done on the stuff that they blog about? Are there editors standing behind them when they write online, just as there is when they're writing stories for print?
Well, if they're official blogs and they actually represent the news organization, then yes, there would be somebody, because they're not going to let somebody just go turn them loose in the blogosphere and say, go do what you want to do. But I guess what I'm saying more is, if you've got a reporter, say I'm covering a story, say I'm in Baghdad covering that story, and I decide I want to run my own blog. And So I do that, but I do it not in conjunction with my assignment from my news organization. I do it on my own. It's my blog. I do it and whatever. And I'm running my own material. The question, I guess, is because you're employed by somebody, do they own all your time? Do they own whatever you're putting out there on the blogosphere? How do you separate that? And, you know, but it's in many ways, it's going back to the era before the internet. If I were a reporter and I was, you know, writing stuff for the Chicago Tribune, I could also write letters to people and give them my opinion. So what you're doing is essentially that, you know, and I'm not sure how much ownership the news organizations can claim over an individual.
Let's take a call. We have our phone lines open, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455, and a caller on line two in Champaign is here. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. I just wanted to mention that I heard, and unfortunately I cannot recall the person's name, who was a newscaster, and I think it was at one of these, I think the president was there, and it was news people. And one of the people got up and said, you know, reporters have life really easy. The administration makes a statement. We reporters write it down, and suddenly it gets put in the paper. And there's no evaluation. You just print the words that the administration, our Republican administration, is doing on the economy, on the war, on foreign affairs, all these kinds of things, and that there is no real investigatory journalism. It's all just writing down what people in Washington say. And, you know, it's like listen pretty much to public radio for my news and public TV. And I'm always hearing, you know, what the administration said. And I don't hear anybody countering that or having a different point of view. And may I ask, sir, how long has it been since you've actually been an on-staff reporter or an editor?
I've been at the University of Illinois since 1997.
So that's 9 years?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you came here before the Bush administration began controlling the media conglomeration.
Let me interrupt you very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, having spent 25 years in the business, I can tell you that every administration I've ever been associated with has tried to control the news, whether the Democrats, Republicans, or whatever they are. It doesn't make any difference. Everybody wants to control what the press says. And the other thing is this. I know a lot of the reporters who are working in Washington. I know their reputations, and to paint them broadly as if they're some kind of stool pigeons for the administration is really an unfair indictment. I think most good reporters who are really professionals and who take their work seriously will not take anything at face value. They always go and try to get other either confirmation of something, or they try to get other folks to talk about it, or try to reach the other side of an issue. Because if you're not doing that, you're not doing your job as a reporter. That's basic reporting. That's what we teach in our college, what we teach in the Department of Journalism. You must go out and get multiple sources for every story. No matter if the president is telling you something or the secretary of state or whoever it is, you go get other information. You never accept anything at face value. So reporters who are doing that are not very good reporters, but I think most of them don't do that. And that's how I that's just kind of my reaction to what you said before.
Okay, well, the reason I do read the newspapers as well sometimes, and that is nobody ever disagrees with what Washington says. It just gets printed as spoken. There's no evaluation. I mean, it is truthful because
well, what newspapers are you reading?
The administration set the News Gazette.
Do you read the Tribune or the New York Times or the Washington Post?
Sometimes I read those, yes. But basically, it's the opinion of the administration. And also, I should say, that ever since there has been the conglomeration of media control, that it's very hard to find an independent news source. Now, this town has the independent eye from the independent media center.
Well, the News Gazette's an independent news organization. It's not owned by any chain or any conglomerate. It's locally owned.
Very, very Republican, and has always been very, very Republican.
Well, I mean, that's their editorial policy. I don't know if you can how that bleeds
in the newspapers. In the newspapers, sometimes.
Well, how can you give me an example of how they do that? I mean, because I would like to do this. I think a lot of people. I hear this all the time. I would like to sit down with you know a person like you and some other folks who believe this and go through the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune and show you exactly in every story how different opinions on different areas are being examined in each story. They are not accepting at face value. I just, you know, I can show you almost story by story by story. That's not the case. But you know what happens? People read what they want to read, and they understand what they want to understand. And if you don't want to, if people aren't open to the other side or whatever, that's the problem of the reader or the viewer. It's not, you know, I think the reporters are putting it out there, but people have to be willing to go and look for it and read the story from top to bottom.
Well, do you ever listen to Media Matters and On the Media at 11 to 12 and 12 to 1? No, I'm sorry. 12
on
to
Sunday,
1
Sunday
and 1
afternoon.
To 2 on Saturday afternoon.
Sunday.
Saturday.
No, they're Sunday afternoon,
Sunday?
Actually. Yes.
Are they Sunday? Yes, you're right. I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. It is on Sunday. I beg your pardon. And I hear things on there that I never read in the newspaper.
But do you know if they're accurate? Let me ask you that. Do you know if they're accurate? Are you sure that what's being said in a form like that, that what's being said is absolutely 100% accurate?
Well,
often these are opinions. Everybody has an opinion about this. Everybody has an opinion about the media, and people like to say, we know how the media operate. We know what the media do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the whole idea of the horrible, you know, monolithic, terrible corporate media is really, I think, overstated often. I think it's really not, you know, I come out of that world, and I can tell you we took great pains, and every story I wrote and every editor I worked with to make sure we were presenting accurate, good, well-vetted, and well-organized and compelling stories. We were not part of some big national conspiracy to pull the wool over the eyes of the public.
Let's start to conclude. We've got some calls that are also waiting.
I'm going to hang up, but let me talk about the big movement by the administration to sell the internet to two huge companies, which will then make money and charge for what is done free now on the internet. And you just, you know, that there are no counter stories in the News Gazette or in the other papers that I have looked at that say, wait a minute, there's a whole bunch of people out there who want to keep the internet the way it is.
Well, but the last time I looked, nobody owned the internet.
Yes, but they're about to sell it. And
but how can they sell it if they don't own it? I mean, the internet belongs to everybody. It's a billion people or several billion people.
No, it doesn't. The administration is looking to give two organizations,
Verizon. But the internet is all over the world.
I know, but if you listen, sir, they're planning to sell.
But how can they sell us something that is in Japan or in Germany or in Africa or whatever? They can't sell something they don't own.
Please make it short.
They're trying to sell the American part of the internet to Verizon and AT&T. And there was a bill in Congress to sell that, and it didn't quite make it through. And I'm hoping that there will be a lot of Democrats elected this November so that bill will definitely fail.
All right. Thanks.
I have not seen that anywhere in the main media. I hear that only on places like On the Media and Media Matters.
Okay, that is the issue of net neutrality. I'm sure if you do a Google search for net neutrality, you'll be able to find some sources. Thanks for your call. Let's move on to, I believe, line one in Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah, but the Google search probably won't give you a lot of mainstream reports on it because it isn't in their interest. And there is a corporate media that is dominating. I don't know. Maybe you should take the approach that things have gotten worse since you left in 97. But you will grant that there that whether it was 911 or what, there has been a cowing of the press in this country.
No,
will you grant that?
I would never admit that. No.
Well, I would refer you to the Michael Massing article in the New York Review of Books, and then more recently, the Columbia Journalism Review has what looks like a great story about called Failures of Imagination by Eric Umansky. And this talks to Charlotta Gall, who is the New York Times correspondent in Afghanistan, is on record as saying she multiple times tried to report stories that were then suppressed by the editors.
At the New York Times?
Yes. Hmm. Sarah Chase, who was in Afghanistan contemporaneously, she's an NPR stringer. She is now speaking about how she multiply sent stories to NPR, and they were not found to be suitable. Things like, if you want specifics...
Well, let me ask you a question very quickly. Is it were not suitable because of their quality or because of their content? And that's a big if.
Well, you can argue that, but let me give a specific then. Sarah Chase was reporting that the special forces were cutting a side deal with a warlord, a Northern League guy, undercutting Karzai about the province in the south that is now a big problem. The guy is back in. He was kicked out by Karzai, but he's now back in again. Whilst we were lionizing Karzai and making him out to be such a wonderful guy, the special forces were cutting another side deal, and Sarah Trace tried to report that, and it wouldn't go through. And it has a lot of implications about the mess of Afghanistan right now. And for you to say there hasn't been a cowering of the press is just beyond belief. I cite again Michael Massing in the
You're talking about somebody who has an opinion. My opinion is it has not
been. I'm talking about documentation. I'm talking about journalists who are finally telling the stories of the stories.
Well, I mean, I know a lot of journalists out there who still are telling the stories and are not being shut down by anybody. You know, so you're talking about one side of an issue, and you're talking about people.
3 years later, we hear the story.
I'm just trying to tell you there are people who may feel
attached to a rock on the front page of the New York Times when she had no quotable sources, no identifiable sources. I mean, boy, you got to the ivory tower at the right time, guy. I just can't.
You know, but the thing is, I'm telling you, there are people out there who may have been cowed, but I know a lot of them who have not been, and I never was when I was working. So I was able to publish anything that I got my hands on because the Tribune trusted my reporting skills and they trusted the stories that I was putting together. And nobody ever told me in my entire career at the Tribune, no, we can't run that story because it doesn't fit our policy or our view of the world, ever.
Actually, one can make the argument that the Tribune, because it is not regarded as a, quote, newspaper of record, has actually broken stories that don't get in to the New York Times or the Washington Post, because those are the official stories that histories are written from, and the time I'll grant you that the Tribune has actually knocked through some of these barriers of limits of allowable debate. I don't know. Maybe I should cite the Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent. I don't know if you've ever read it, really, but there is definitely a conspiracy of silence, if you will, a self-censorship. I think that's why a lot of alcoholics why a lot of journalists are alcoholic, because the discrepancy between what they see and what they can actually get their editors to print. I'll let someone else have a chance.
All right, thanks for your call, and let's move on to line four in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I will not be contentious. I'm just curious.
Contention is good.
It's okay. I'm used to it.
Yeah, I can tell, sir. You did a good job. What is your take about the Valerie Flame, Joseph Wilson, Richard Armitage, and Robert Novak story? I heard him on. I guess Mr. Novak is at the University of Illinois. He was on C-SPAN, sort of spouting his own conservative line on it. But what is your take on that story?
Well, we were just discussing that a little bit before we went on the air. I think the problem with stories like that is, it really bothers me, is when the reporter becomes the story. And that's sort of what happened in this case in some ways because of Robert Novak's reporting of it, but and the fact that he's been the main conduit for the information coming out up until recently. Right?
If I could ask, though, I should let you finish your point, but I just a point of reference, is it difficult for a reporter that's on that high a level, you know, whether you're a political columnist and obviously a partisan one like Robert Novak or somebody else in the profession who's reporting on, you know, matters of that high importance, is it difficult to avoid being part of the story in some case or another when you're reporting on controversial topics? Is there a way of being, you know, you could be sucked in?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think the thing is this, what's a reporter and what is a person who gives opinion? And, you know, Robert Novak, for all in looking at his entire career, he's always been a columnist, and he's been a columnist who has a specific opinion, and he promotes that opinion in his columns. And it's just like in the past, all these columnists were – they're not – I don't look at them the same way I don't look at people who are on these shows like, you know, Hannity and Combs and, you know, Chris Matthews and all these – these people are talking heads who have a point of view and, in my mind, have no credibility as reporters. They are opinion makers. They are opinion purveyors or whatever, but they are not reporters. And, you know, the Tribune and most news organizations have rules about this. And if you are going on to a talk show like that, they want you to talk about the story that you worked on, and that's it. And they don't like you to talk about what you think about something or is this right or is that wrong or that person do this or that person do that. Because what you're doing when you do those things is you're destroying your own credibility or at least your ability to be fair and balanced, as they like to say.
Could I ask another question,
sure,
please? What is your take on the general reporting of the Iraq War? In my opinion, it seems like a good deal of the media has been almost serving like a cheerleader function, and maybe till the last 6 months or a year when it seems to be more critical.
Well, that's a very good question. And I think if I were to go back to the previous caller who insists that the media have been cowed, well, that's a very good example. I think the media have been cowed in Iraq for very good reason. I mean, it's a very, very, very dangerous place to work. And you can't go out and cover the story the way you want. You can't go out to neighborhoods and talk to average Iraqis about their lives before fear you're going to be kidnapped or shot or blown up with an IED. You know, and I covered the Vietnam War. We could go any place, any time. Yeah, there was danger involved because there was always a firefight going on someplace. But I could go where I wanted to without a fear of being kidnapped and beheaded by some fringe group or some other group within the country. So I think that the reporting of the war in Iraq is unfortunate. I mean, you're getting a lot of military news. You're not getting much news about people's lives and how they're impacted by the war for the very good reason that it's just very dangerous to do that work. And I really think that nobody is being well served right now until somebody figures out a way so the reporters can get out and actually do their work. But I know that for a fact it's very, very difficult. It's very expensive. Almost all these reporters and all these news organizations have to pay huge amounts of money for security, going out in multiple cars and, you know, with armed guards. I can't even imagine working in that environment as a reporter.
Thanks for your call. And just to bring up a piece of information in front of me that so far since the Iraq conflict began, 60 journalists have been killed in Iraq. So far this year, worldwide, 47 journalists have been killed in a report that covers the entire world, conflicts ranging from the Iraq War to conflicts in the Philippines and other parts of the world where it is difficult safety-wise to cover stories. Is there, however, a difference in the amount of freedom that a reporter has in a place like Iraq covering the military as opposed to, and you had mentioned before, you have had some experience covering the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. You know, how has the nature changed in that time?
Lots. I mean, for one thing, when I covered the war in Vietnam, you were not embedded. If I saw a helicopter going out someplace, I'd go run over and say, where are you headed? And they were going out to Quang Tri, we're going out to the Parrot's Beak or whatever along the Cambodian border. And I'd say, can I come along? They say, sure, hop on, and off we'd go. That doesn't work this way. I mean, now it works a different way. Now you have reporters being embedded with specific units so that what they do is they stick with that unit and they see that slice of the war with that unit, and they don't see much else. And, I mean, part of it is obviously it's safer perhaps for them to be with one unit like that than jumping around. And the other part of it, of course, is that I think the military wants to try to control the way journalists operate, and that if they have you in a situation where you're embedded with a particular unit and you can't jump from one unit to the other, they're controlling you. They're keeping you under wraps. And I think that's, once again, to go back to the previous caller who was intimating and charging that the media are cowed, I don't know if they're being cowed, but they're certainly being manipulated in that way. And I think that's a problem. But I don't know what else you do about it, because if you go back into the World War II, reporters were embedded with units then too, and it was much more onerous than it is even today in some ways, because you actually had censors looking at every story that they filed.
Right. Let's go to the phones again. Again, our numbers are 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Your questions for Ron Yates, the dean of the College of Communications, are certainly welcome. Let's go to line one in Urbana. Good afternoon. Hello, we're line... how about line three? I'm sorry, line three.
Okay. Well, Dr. Yates has made a nice rallying defense of the reporters, and that's nice, but I kind of agree with the caller that gave him a hard time.
You didn't give me a hard time.
Well,
just lively discourse.
Kind of going at it there a little bit. But you raised a challenge earlier, you know, if you'd like to pick up New York Times or the Chicago Tribune and go through it story by story, and that's a challenge I have to take up. But I'll give you one example. The way the media is being cowed, in a sense, is the way they pick up the words that they get handed. For instance, Operation Iraqi Freedom. I'm sure you won't contend that hasn't appeared in the media over and over and over again.
I mean, because that's the word that the military uses
to
describe it?
That's the word that the government gave them.
Right. Well, I mean, it's like, going into, I go back to the Vietnam era. They had also these operations.
Oh, yeah.
Same with names, and we used to refer to those names, too, because they were operations, and that was the operational name that the thing was given. But, I see Operation, Iraqi Freedom.
Well, that's a little bit of the news itself. I mean,
sure,
somebody saw it, and maybe it's even true that it was about freedom, and perhaps it was, but the point is when you repeat the word, you condone it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And another example, I think I just heard it today or yesterday on NPR, you know, that there was a battle someplace, I don't remember where, Afghanistan, I guess, and they said, 40 terrorists were killed. End of story. Yeah, every time I hear that, whether it's Afghanistan or no matter what it is, I often wonder, well, yeah, they estimated there were 40 bodies or... But
mm-hmm.
You're expected to accept that 40 terrorists were killed, when I'm going to guess that most of the time 30 civilians and two bystanders and 8 terrorists might have been killed, something like that. So it's just this constant repetition of these blurbs that, well, you even just mentioned that you can't be there. It's dangerous.
No, that's a good point. And I tell you something. This goes back to the U.S. Civil War when Secretary of War Stanton set up a system in Washington where he would issue bulletins every day about the number of Confederate soldiers killed and the number of Union soldiers killed, and it was complete baloney. And when I got to Vietnam, we had the same thing. It was the 5 o'clock fall, as we called it, and we'd be, 425 enemy KIA and so many American KIA, and so many MIA and all that. And, you just took it with a grain of salt. That's the military at work. I mean, that's what reporters are supposed to be doing. They should be looking beyond those statements, and they need to be working, working to find out what the truth is there. But the thing is, and I go back to what I said before, I've been in Afghanistan. I worked there and when the Russians were in there, and I went with the Mujahideen, and I was with these guerrillas. And I know, I'm telling, when you get into that part of the world, and especially that Pakistani-Afghani frontier where we know Osama bin Laden probably is still ensconced somewhere, it is hairy, dangerous territory. And if you're, I think, I'm a reporter for, the Daily Bugle, I'm going to go out and find the truth, and you take off on a camel or something and go across Afghanistan, you're not going to come out alive. It is very, very dangerous there. Someone's going to shoot you or you're going to be captured. So it's very hard to get to the truth of these stories, and I think you raise a good point.
Given that you can't often, maybe mostly, can't get out there and get the story, that doesn't completely excuse the media from at least using the word alleged.
No, right. You're right. Hey, listen, I'm not even giving
them
a pass on getting out and getting the story. I think that that's part of your job. If you're going to be a correspondent and cover war, you have to take the risks, and you've got to go out and do these things. And it's not easy, and it's not safe. And it's who said it was? So I think it's incumbent upon journalists to go out and find the truth, even if it is dangerous finding it. You know, and so I'm not giving him a pass on not going off on that camel across to Afghanistan. You know,
I don't think I was. All I was saying is that if and when you can't, mm-hmm. you shouldn't pass along the official story without having
absolutely correct
some kind of a caveat to it, alleged or something like that. Anyway, I've given you a hard enough time.
No,
I'm
no, you haven't.
The trip
no.
See if I can come up with.
You raised some excellent points. You didn't give me a hard time, and I appreciate the call. It was good. You had some good questions.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling. Let's go to line two in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi. I was wondering if you could give me your thoughts about Judy Miller's interactions with the administration and also with the New York Times' decision to wait to publish some potentially damaging information about the administration until after the 2004 election. I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, I only know what I read in the papers myself. I was not privy to into the inside happenings with the New York Times and the Judith Miller story, but I know that, what I read, and it was an unfortunate, I thought, situation in which somebody might have been used. And ultimately what happened, she's no longer at the New York Times. And I think this is it's a problem that as a reporter, you have to be aware of these things at all times. You've got to be watchful of how somebody would try to manipulate a story and use you as a conduit to do that. And I think that this is an example, in a way, of that problem.
Thanks for your call. We have possibly time for another call to slip in by the end of the show. 1-800-222-9455 or in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. One sort of media circus story that some of us are not too kind to look upon, but it's something that you have to face is what happened recently is the JonBenet Ramsey murder. Suddenly got back into the headlines this year with an arrest. And eventually the person who was arrested was suddenly not arrested and was freed, cleared of charges. However, for as minor as that case may be in some other situations, it made screaming headlines in papers around the world. Why does the media have the fascination for this type of case, and why? How do you think it got to that point where all that that hype ended in a situation where a person was let go and not charged with something?
Well, my short answer, two words: cable television. You know, I think that's a 24/7 monster that has to be fed all the time. And when you've got these people, facing the horrendous possibility of dead airtime, and you've got a story like this that has some kind of a fascination for the American public because this little girl and all those that video of her dancing and her costume looking like a miniature 30-year-old. I mean, to me, it says something about our society. It says something about where we've gone. It says something about how we view children. It says something about, frankly, it says something about child pornography almost. You know, I mean, you're looking at all these areas, and I think there's you put all that together, and there's a fascination with these kinds of stories. And certainly a little girl being killed brutally the way she was on the day after Christmas. I mean, you know, it has a lot of pull for the public. However, if you go back and as a reporter and you look at that case and you look at all the other children who are killed and abused and horribly treated in our country, that's a minor part of it. But there is this fascination with this particular case because, first of all, wealthy family, very pretty little girl, and all these the mysterious thing. Did the parents do it? Did they not do it? Or, you know, was there a break-in? Was there not? And of course, then the way the authorities bungled the whole investigation in Boulder. I mean, I think there's a whole broad array of reasons why that story played, but I think it was. I mean, I think it was way overplayed by the media. I think they went way off the deep end with that story, and they shouldn't have done it. And when this thing happened in Thailand, rather than to really look into whether or not this person had or had not had anything to do with the story or with the murder, I just think they just took a lot at face value and they got sucked into it like everybody else.
And there have been incidents like that in the past where the media has taken it on the chin for overreacting to a story.
Mm-hmm.
What is it, though, is there any way for a media outlet to temper itself? Is it market pressure that's keeping them putting this story, you know, on television in a constant way? Is it the fear that if we don't do it, somebody else will?
Sure.
And they'll turn to that station?
Absolutely.
even though it seems like public opinion,
right, but I mean,
you know, on one level says we're tired of hearing about this,
right,
case.
Here's to give you another example. Okay, Rick Kaplan, who is one of our alums and who went off and did all kinds of things in the world of broadcast journalism,
and has headed CNN and MSNBC at one
right.
time or another,
and he just stepped down at MSNBC. But he told me that he ordered that MSNBC would no longer show live coverage of car chases in California, where they seem to always take place. And he said, "We're not doing that anymore because that just feeds this frenzy, and it gets people to do it more and more. They want to get on television. This is their 15 minutes of fame or whatever, and they'll do these things." So he stopped doing it, and that was a decision that he made because he thought it was not that's not worthwhile news. It's titillating. Maybe that truck's going to turn over. Maybe he's going to run into a train or something. You know, and we'll see some horrible accident, and that's just appealing to people's purient kind of morbid curiosity. And I think that's just what you should not be doing. And networks or cable outfits that do that are doing a disservice to the public, I think.
Let's wrap this up with one question as we sort of look ahead to political season, and we're going to see in Illinois and across the country, you know, organizations spending a lot of time talking about candidates, or hopefully a lot of time talking about candidates. There's discussions about how much time news organizations devote anymore to political issues. What are you going to be watching for? What kinds of things will interest you as you head into this political season?
Well, I want to see first of all that when a candidate makes a statement about, first of all, there are a couple of things I see all the time. First of all, you have the people who are in power and the people who are out of power. The people out of power, like, they wind up criticizing those who are in power. I'm not talking about Republicans over Democrats or Democrats over Republicans or whatever. I'm talking about those in power and those out of power. So the out of power people will criticize those in power and say they're doing it all wrong. What I see missing in this debate is, what are you going to do? I have never heard anybody yet come up with an idea of, okay, this is how we're going to do it differently. They just say, we're doing it differently. But I don't know what it is they're going to do differently. I'd like to know more about that. So I hope that reporters will press candidates. I'm not talking just about the national races or whatever. I'm talking about all the races that are going on. They need to press these candidates on exactly what it is they are going to do if they get elected. And I think you hold their feet to the fire then.
How difficult is that when you've got candidates who are being managed by consultants who say the exact opposite thing?
Right.
Don't be specific.
Well, then I think they need to say that.
You could hang yourself by being specific.
Well, sure. But I think the reporters, it's up to the reporters to say, we've asked this question, you know, 25 times, and this person's handler is not letting them answer. So that should tell you something about what kind of a person this will be when he or she gets into office, you know, and that's what the reporters should be doing. Press. Get an answer from these people. Don't let them pull the wool over your eyes, and don't let them make these incredible promises, which they know are never going to be kept. You know, and I think that's where the media can do a service to the public, viewing, reading, or listening public.
All right. With that, we wrap things up. Ron Yates, the Dean of Communication of the College of Communications at the U of I, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's been an entertaining hour.
Yes, it has.
And we hope to do this again sometime.
I love to do it.